Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. It's European preseason and hope springs eternal, my fellow Americans. There's more than enough news to trip the trigger of the obsessive American soccer fan. Players getting fresh starts, prospects playing in first-team friendlies, goals, assists, trials, loans. Greg, on a scale of 7 to 10, how excited are you right now?
Pels, I don't understand your rating system at all, but I'm going to put myself at a solid 8.6. It's good. The World Cup, I think, had me probably on your scale, probably like a 9.8 with like a minor technical deduction based on the U.S. being absent. But between MLS, these midweek preseason friendlies, and sort of the circus of the transfer market, I feel like it's all just enough to avoid withdrawal.
Yeah, it feels like there's a new energy post-World Cup, at least around the men's national team, at least on Twitter.com.
Well, the way I sort of read it is every time one of these kids, one of our savior committee members, steps onto the field, it almost becomes like this tiny miniature U.S. men's national team friendly, mm-hmm. where we get to like get a look at someone because we're in this unique situation where we're turning over virtually the entire team. It's just every little data point we can get, we're grasping for.
Right. Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. So it's all happening. A lot is happening. And today we'll start by running it all down. We'll get into what it all means shortly because Greg loves to get meta on this stuff. The first one, the big one, is Christian Pulisic. Had a brace versus Liverpool. Keeps earning penalties. This time he buried his penalty, which has not always been his strong suit. And his second goal for the win over his future boss, Jurgen Klopp, was a well-taken strike from the top of the box on a counterattack. Landon Donovan-esque, I must say. Looked very Landon Donovan-y to me. Some people won't see that as a compliment, but I do. So is he going to have a breakout year, I guess? That's the big question, right?
Yeah, no, he's not gonna. It's not. You can't call it a breakout year. He's already broken out. This would have to be at best a resurgence. Bells, I'm nothing if not pedantic.
Yeah, I mean a resurgence, a breakout from his breakout. You know, breakout. He broke out as like a legit Bundesliga
17-year-old phenom.
Yeah, and then he sort of plateaued, right?
No, just, yeah, he went from the 17-year-old phenom to the 18-year-old, like, suddenly he's, like, this grizzled veteran grinding out results in the Bundesliga.
Okay, so will he have a resurgence?
He's gonna do better than last year. He's going to be fine. He's going to be dynamic and dangerous. I still don't think I don't think they're going to make too much noise, say, in the Champions League. I think they're a few big signings away from that.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that he gets back to at least being exciting to watch and looking like he's having fun under new management.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, a lot of people are saying that Lucien Favre is a much better manager than Peter Stöger and Peter Boss. And, you know, that's not a very high bar, but if he can reinstitute some sort of flowing attacking identity at Dortmund, that's really all we need. Who cares if they give up 5 goals a game, you know?
Right. From an American. Yeah, we're here just for the Pulisic show. So that's I hope to see some of that swagger. I'll say this, like, I would urge anyone to not like adjust their expectations based on him pantsing a couple guys in the preseason international friendlies. These friendlies mean like literally nothing. Even in a normal year, they mean nothing. And in a World Cup summer, I mean, it's like a charity event. They just kind of come out and dick around for 90 minutes.
Yeah, right. And even I was going to mention this. Even last year, in the first couple weeks of the Bundesliga, Pulisic looked like an absolute menace, if you remember. I think it was against Wolfsburg. He had a goal, a really, really nice goal, and looked like the most dangerous player out there. I think he had like a goal or an assist the next game. And I remember thinking, oh man, this is it. Superstar. Like, this can be a superstar season. And that, those were regular season games. And he ended up not, you know, carrying that form very far forward.
Right.
And of course, right. There are a ton of reasons for that. And most of them aren't his fault. I acknowledge all that. But bottom line, 5 goals, 7 assists in over 3,000 minutes in all competitions is not, those aren't elite numbers.
No, those are the numbers that we need to have that resurgence from. So, let's enjoy it. Let's enjoy the whatever preseason games he plays, and just get to watch him having some fun, and then we'll actually see what happens when the numbers count.
Yep. Okay, moving right along. Keaton Parks getting preseason minutes and an assist for Benfica over the weekend, I believe. Still not sure where he lies in the pecking order. By the time most of you listen to this, Keaton Parks and Christian Pulisic will hopefully have faced off in a friendly here in the States when Dortmund faces Benfica. I don't know how much there is to say about Parks. I don't have a good read on the situation, really.
No, and again, there's just no way to gain any useful information. Even stuff managers say should be taken with a grain of salt. Whether they say somebody's really competing for a first team or you have to wait until late August for anything to actually matter.
All right, King Solomon, everything is meaningless.
So I'm just going to repeat that for this for everyone you talk about.
It'll be a great segment. It's Tim Weah scored a goal, started as the 9 for PSG. Has allegedly been assigned a number for the regular season, number 21. Anybody following me on Twitter can check out a thread of GIFs of Weah's performance in that game. I thought he looked really good. I mean, we don't have to keep saying that these games are meaningless because I recognize that. But
no, this is a good one to really hammer that point home because and you pointed it out, the center back he's up against was also like an 18-year-old kid. And then in the second half, he spent 30 minutes running against Chris Richards, who's an FC Dallas product on loan. So that just kind of gives you the idea. It's PSG versus Bayern, but it's not really PSG versus Bayern.
No, but, you know, on the other hand, Franck Ribéry was on the field. So was Arjen Robben, Javi Martinez. I mean, it was a mix, right? It was a mix. It was for Bayern. There were a few more veterans than there were for PSG, but at least on the Bayern side, there was a pretty healthy mix. Renato Sanchez he's had a couple of tough years, but he has been a borderline world class holding midfielder in his life at one point. But yeah, anyway, I just want to say about Weah. We don't know what Thomas Tuchel is thinking. That's the manager at PSG. And we won't know, I don't think, probably until the regular season starts. I think it's still possible Weah could go out on loan. It's possible he could make the roster and get spot minutes with PSG. I don't even really know what's preferable for him at this point. But he did look... We got a good... I think the game gave us a good sense of, like, where he is right now. Just if you watched him play, he's very clean on the ball. He's pretty strong on the ball too, surprisingly, in my opinion. He's not a game breaker with the ball at his feet, you know? He's not going to make that killer pass. He's not going to dribble a guy and unlock the defense that way. But he does move off the ball very, very well. We've talked about this before on the podcast. Extremely.
Yeah, he plays really simple. Good movement after a pass.
Yeah. And, if I'm sitting on the sideline, I see that. I think, you know, that's useful, especially if you have Mbappe. And if he can hold on to the ball, if he can move and then hold on to the ball and, you know, make another simple pass. If you have Mbappe and Di Maria around him and, you know, who knows who else, Neymar. You'd think he would have plenty of opportunities to score goals.
it's a fun like scenario to consider.
Yeah.
That Tim Weah could be spending the fall running combinations with those guys.
You think he'll probably end up going on loan or?
I don't know what PSG do with their prospects who sit behind their $100 million mega stars. Like, I don't know if he'll go on loan. I don't know if he'll just sit on the youth team. They can use him for league games or cup games where, again, they'll essentially clinch the title in the first 3 or 4 weeks of the season. And then all they're concentrating on is Champions League after that. So that's what everything's sort of geared towards that as far as player rotation. And if they keep him and decide he's in their plans even a little bit, he'll play a lot because they'll have a lot of games that are not competitive or meaningful because they're so much better than everyone else in France.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's an interesting point because I would have said, like, worst case scenario is he's on the bench and he never really plays meaningful minutes. But maybe that's not the worst case if there's all these cup games to play and stuff.
Yeah, no, I think it'd be great because I assume there would be, like, rotation. They wouldn't, run out a completely different 11. So in some games he would be playing in the same game as Neymar or Mbappe, and that would just be awesome. Yeah. From a national team perspective, it wouldn't get much better than that.
Yeah, just running up the score on Bordeaux. Saint-Étienne.
Suck it, Lyon.
Right. Although they might be reasonably good. Didn't they just win the Europa League
competition?
Next up, Josh Sargent found the back of the net a couple times for Werder Bremen. In tune-up games, the 18-year-old striker typically hasn't been starting with the ostensible first-choice team in Bremen. But again, this is just kind of a black box for me. I don't really know what's happening or where he lies in the pecking order, and I'm not sure anybody really does outside of Florian Kohfeldt, the manager.
We won't, but this is where the work you do is really super valuable because back in the old days, we'd literally just be refreshing websites every Monday to see how everyone did over the weekend, and it would always just be a list, and it would say Josh Sargent started and played 70 minutes for Werder Bremen, scored one goal, and be like, awesome, he's scoring a goal. But then when you come in and you actually have these like clips of either his touches or his goal, and it in this case for Sargent, it kind of shows again just how like meaningless some of these games are. So yeah. I think his first goal of the preseason was in like the team had two games that day and played their first team in one game and sort of their second team in the other in the second game. And Sargent played the second game, and his goal, I don't know if you remember it, came on like a ball that gets squared across the box, and there are literally like four Werder Bremen attackers running onto this ball, all unmarked.
Yeah.
Any of them could have touched it in. And so, you know what I mean? Like, because Josh Sargent scores that goal, it's not suddenly moving the needle on any kind of a manager's evaluation process saying, yeah, this guy is like a finisher or anything like that. It was so like a non-goal. I don't know how to put it.
Yeah, it was anticlimactic for sure. And he also had an assist in that game, but I think it was rather than two games, it was just like a total line change at halftime.
Sure.
And it was, I think the final score was like 12-0 or something. I mean, just something ridiculous. Right. So we're going to do, I'll just plug the future here a little bit. I'm going to do a Bundesliga preview and talk to a bunch of podcasters who cover German clubs. And we're going to talk to one of the guys from Radio Free Wieser, which is, the only, as far as we know, English language Bremen podcast, and get a hopefully very clear idea of what's going on with Josh Sargent.
That's good. That'll be the real like insight. Because again, you just can't tell from stats when teams are winning preseason games. I think Everton won a game like 22-0. You're just it's a finishing drill. So if you score five goals in a finishing drill, so what? I mean, that's not what's gonna move you up the depth chart.
Right. Let's not, you know, pull the rug out from under all the excitement just yet here. Emerson Hyndman at Bournemouth sure seems like he's getting a shot to make the first team. He's started in friendlies against Sevilla and Levante, two very respectable La Liga clubs, and scored a goal against Levante, which was really nice. It's out there on the internet somewhere. I haven't gifted it, but somebody's put a video out. He looks like he's a lot bigger and stronger than he was a year ago. And I had, you know, honestly, I had kind of given up on him. I didn't think he was going to ever make the team at Bournemouth. And maybe he won't, but it does seem like Eddie Howe, the manager there, is giving him a shot. So that's good.
That's promising. Hyman, and then the,
well,
no, go on.
One more thing about Hyman. He's kind of a number eight, who can kind of be a 10 or kind of be a 6, you know, depending on how the team is set up. Just for anybody who doesn't know who he is, grew up in Dallas.
Go on, Emerson.
Been languishing in England for 3 or 4 years now.
Doesn't it seem like at this point, England is where our players are going to languish?
It does. Yeah, the languishing fields of England. Very much so. I hope nobody goes there ever again.
I'm the same. Get onto the continent.
Yeah. I mean, things have always been a little nicer on the continent, haven't they?
What are we turning into, like a travelogue? All right, let's get to our favorite left back.
Food is certainly better on the continent, right? Left back, Anthony Robinson, also pushing for a spot on a Premier League roster. I've heard he played well. He looked a little shaky in his last appearance for Everton. Sorry, everybody. This is just another we don't know what's going on. I think the realistic possibility is he could end up being Leighton Baines' backup, and Leighton Baines is getting on in years.
Right. I would be thrilled if he doesn't go out on loan and he's on match day rosters for Everton. Even if he's not starting, I'd be happy with that. I assume he would get games eventually, whether it's cup games or again just during the busy fixtures of the year, just in the rotation. I'd be thrilled.
Yeah, I'm starting to auger for a loan, just to guarantee that he gets 90 minutes every week, or in the case of the championship, every 3 days, you know. He plays so many games. Andrew Carlton got his first MLS start for Atlanta. So this is obviously nothing to do with Europe, but it sort of fits into the general excitement about national team pool.
Kids, yeah.
This one's
real. This one matters. This isn't a nothing situation. These points from this game matter. So I'm not downplaying this one at all.
Okay. Ding 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 ding. We hit.
Yeah, you got me.
One. My initial impression was that he had kind of a mixed performance. I'm here to admit that I was probably wrong about that. I rewatched the game last night, or rewatched most of it, and he was really good. He looked really good. I think he could have been a little bit sharper, but he was involved in two goals. He was mostly smart and wise with his choices. What did you think? Did you watch the game?
Yeah, I watched it. So I think I was really like, I was content with it, if that makes sense. Like, he looked like a professional. He definitely didn't blow the doors off anything, but you know, that other than Joseph Martinez, like, this is what you want a player to do, is to go out in his first start and look like a real professional. And so good on Andrew Carlton.
Yeah. The performance is a little bit like a fine wine with me. It's getting better with age. Tata Martino gave him a big smile and tousled his blonde hair as he walked off the field. You don't see Tata smiling a lot, so that was kind of nice to see. And never, you know, he was given the, we should probably mention he was given the chance because Ezekiel Barco was suspended under extremely inauspicious circumstances, which we don't need to get into. Most of you know what that is. But he sees the chance, I think it's fair to say.
Yes, it's a situation where Tata can be like, Andrew Carlton did not hurt us in this game. So it's not like, you know, I didn't have to hide him or whatever else. He can say Andrew Carlton is a useful player in our lineup. So, again, that's a good output for his first start. Let's see if it translates to more minutes.
Yeah. The word is Barco is also suspended this weekend. I forget who Atlanta is playing, but hopefully we'll get to see another Carlton start.
And hopefully he'll be playing against another U.S. like 19-year-old. Oh, they're playing Montreal. I don't know if Montreal has a bunch of U.S. 19-year-olds, but
no.
But it was cool to see that.
33-year-olds.
It was cool to see that against DC.
Yeah, Durkin was lining up on the other side. He's at this point he's a guaranteed starter for DC, or has been at least for the last several weeks. I gotta admit I wasn't paying as close of attention to Durkin as I was to Carlton because I've been jiffing the heck out of Durkin all season long. But I thought he looked so-so. Did you think he was better than that, worse than that?
No, I thought he was. I didn't. Yeah, I mean. It's, what would we say? Atlanta United is going to make a lot of holding midfielders look so-so when they're playing at Atlanta.
Yeah. Yeah, that, this is not the technical term for it, but that sort of blitzkrieg attack, that just extremely vertical and fast attack, it just makes mincemeat of everybody in MLS pretty much, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
And DC's not the team to come into Atlanta and slug out a result. They're just too porous at the back. And Wayne Rooney, sidebar, Wayne Rooney didn't look awfully good in that game. He did crush Andrew Carlton one time, which I noticed.
That's good for both those guys. It's good for Wayne Rooney to take out some aggression. It's good for Carlton to get knocked down.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Okay, heading back over to Europe, Weston McKennie. It's been, as far as I can tell, I haven't been able to watch any of the streams, but as far as I can tell, looking about par for Schalke. Not, you know, announcing himself as an unquestioned starter, but not doing anything really to hurt himself in the pecking order. There's nothing really that meaningful to say about it, I guess, but.
No, business as usual over there for McKennie.
Just gotta acknowledge that arguably our best player is still at Schalke. Shaq Moore on the bench at second division Spanish side today, I saw on the internet.
So he's moved, right? He is on loan?
Yeah, he's on loan in the second tier in Spain, a club kit called CF Reus.
Okay.
You know, if he can get minutes, that's great.
Right.
I mean, I guess one thing we should say as we're mentioning all these names is everybody we're talking about is like 21 and under, you know?
Yes. I think Hinman's the oldest guy at 22.
Yeah. Jonathan Amon's still recuperating at FC Nordsjælland. I'm really anxious to see him back on the field again. I'm sure he's anxious to get out there. But hasn't even been in a lineup for a while.
And their season has started, right?
Yeah, they're well underway. I think they've had two Europa League qualifiers. They did advance over like some club in England that I'd never heard of, Clifton FC.
Oh sure, Clifton.
Had you heard of them? Seriously? Oh,
Clifton FC. No, not Clifton FC. No. Yeah, I see the Danish league is 2 weeks into their season, the Super League. Okay.
All right. Well, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, just I feel like Amon's been recovering from injury for like the last 11 months.
He's been injured far more than he's been healthy. That is
okay.
It's a little bit worrisome.
That's concerning. Okay. Yeah. Well, wishing him the best. Okay. To Sweden.
Staying in Scandinavia. Let's stay on this side of the Baltic Sea for a second. Manuel Sabi, also in the Danish league, a former U.S. youth international. I think he's 21 now. He might only be 20. He started yesterday for a mid-table Danish league side. So, and he's a striker. Can hit the ball with venom.
We need those guys.
Yeah, a lot of pace. A lot of. I mean, he's had some goals in the last 12 months that are really fun to watch on repeat. But
yeah. He's been involved. Has he been involved in the U.S. system? Like he's been on U23 teams or whatever it is.
Yeah, he was on the U20 roster in the 2017 World Cup.
Okay.
But he didn't play much, like 30 minutes total.
All right. Well, maybe the Danish league will make a star of him.
Yeah. Can be a good launching pad. Sweden. Take us to Sweden, Greg.
Yeah. So Roman Gall's made his move to Malmo, Swedish champions. And they just won their first, I think it's the first leg of a Champions League qualifier. He was already included in the game day roster, but he didn't play. I still think that's a good thing that he's already on the roster. I don't know how big those rosters are on the Swedish teams, like if they have a bunch of guys who don't dress for games. But obviously for a Swedish team, getting into the Champions League group stage would probably be the biggest thing they could do in a season other than win the league. So I thought it was a positive sign that he was already included in such a meaningful game for them, included in the lineup.
Yeah, I see that in our notes you gave the Andrew Carlton first MLS start 4 stars, and you gave this one 3 stars. So it's
there were points at stake. Points at stake. There's money on the line here. So
yeah,
that's meaningful.
It's a good point. And Malmo, you know, already just did win the Swedish championship. So I think you're probably right that getting in the Champions League group stage is got to be the priority there right now.
Oh, yeah. Massive payday.
Back to Bayern Munich. And let's give Chris Richards a little bit of consideration here. 18-year-old kid, for the uninitiated. He's 18 years old, grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. Ended up playing for the Houston Texans, I think.
Yeah, Texans SC.
Texans SC. A non-MLS affiliated club in the U.S., eventually they won a national championship of some kind there with him playing center back, and then he signed with FC Dallas pretty recently, like earlier this year, I think. And then there's something in his contract that said he couldn't play first team minutes. Don't ask. I don't understand what that's about. So he's off to Bayern Munich on loan because Dallas and Bayern Munich have some kind of cooperative agreement. Again, it's more complicated than my brain can understand. But at any rate, Richards is there on loan. We're thinking like, hey, he's going to be, you know, playing with the U19s, and we'll get to watch a few streams here and there in the spring when those Bundesliga U19 playoffs are happening. Well, no, he's on the roster for first team friendly, and he gets on the field against PSG, and I thought he looked really good. I mean, you know, with all the caveats that we've been pounding away at.
No, but you can still look good within those caveats. It's just whether that means anything for the next 6 months or whether that means anything for your place in the team's plans is what I'm saying. Don't read into that. But you can look good. Tim Weah looked good. Chris Richards, I thought, also looked really good for Bayern. He wasn't asked to do a lot. I mean, no. It's not like he constantly was being – they weren't running at him for 30 minutes. It was mostly just moving the ball around the back and maintaining possession.
Yeah, that's true. How did you put it?
He's really clean. His it's a really good, like, his economy of motion is excellent for that 30-minute spell. So every time a ball came to him, I mean, this is it's like a little bit elementary, but like his first touch immediately set up to hit his next like pass, and he put it exactly where it was supposed to go to a teammate with the right weight. And that stuff matters. Like I honestly don't see that even when our senior men's team plays in CONCACAF against teams that are sitting back against us. Like we're still like clumsy at times, and this kid just there's no clumsiness to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the few times where he was called into action, he looked very decisive. He bullied the other 18-year-olds he was facing from PSG. All the attackers for PSG that late in the game were under 20. And I think Rabiot, their one sort of first team regular who was in the match, or one of the few, was off the field at that point. So take all that into account. But I don't know. We, from a sort of a narrow U20 roster building perspective, if Chris Richards looks that comfortable, even in a crap friendly, preseason friendly for Bayern Munich, I think he's, you know, I didn't have him listed as a starter when Joey Antonin and I talked about the U20 player pool a week ago, and I'm already ready to change that, you know, make him a starter.
Okay.
Make him a starter on the U20 team. I mean,
well, there you go. And it's, you know, the same thing. While I'm reluctant to draw a ton of conclusions from it, from his performance, the fact still remains that he has a performance for Bayern Munich, which is not something that a lot of our prospects had 5, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any sample size of guys playing 30 minutes for Bayern Munich.
Well, we had one, Julian Green, your favorite player.
Okay, yes.
Okay, now let's move in even further into the realm of speculation. But this stuff does excite the fan base, and it makes me excited when I hear, A, that Alex Mendes is trialing at Freiburg, Richie Ledesma is trialing at PSV Eindhoven, Sebastian Soto is trialing in Germany. He was at Borussia Mönchengladbach in June, and there may be other places that those guys have trialed too that we don't know about. And then Yuli Yanez and Cameron Duke were at Bayern. So there's these like pictures going around on the internet, and Alex Mendes snapped a selfie with Yogi Love somewhere in Germany. Put it on Instagram. Who knows the backstory on that? I have not been
able he was just at a library and just ran across the other.
They ran into each other at a nightclub or something.
Yes, the American wave is washing into Europe, and I couldn't be happier. I'm hopeful that again we start seeing contracts signed in the next month or two for anyone who's able to.
Yep. Yeah, Soto's turning 18 here very shortly, in a couple of days actually. So if we're going to hear news about that, I'm sure that news will be soon. We might have to wait a little longer with Ledesma and Mendes. Yanez and Duke, who knows? You know, I don't. How many 18-year-old Americans does Bayern want? I don't know. There's also Taylor Booth at Bayern, who is deaf. I mean, it's more solid that he's going to be part of that academy system. He doesn't turn 18 for a little while. He's a holding midfielder in the U.S. youth national team setup. And I think Thomas Roberts, a kid at FC Dallas who's teammates with Chris Richards, is going to also go on loan there too. So there's going to be a lot of people at Bayern under the American
flag. Man, I don't. What is Bayern's per diem budget? This is insanity. Okay, so that's awesome. So we're talking probably just in that quick rundown of what's going on in the preseason, we hit like 20 different names of guys under 22 and under.
Yeah.
All not bad, Bells.
Yeah, all with at least something positive to say about him. A lot of activity. We're going to have to turn and face the music here and try to assess all this after this lengthy catalog, and we'll do that right after the break. Okay, with all this activity, it feels like this might be the best youth generation ever. Is it? Is this time different?
Bells, I'm going to surprise you here and say that yes, this time it is different. Normally I'm the cynic and I say no, these are just updated versions of Juan Agudelo or Luis Gil or whoever it would be, because so far everyone has been, you know, all of the right. guys that have come through that we've gotten excited about haven't turned into, really, most of them haven't even turned into national team regulars, much less sort of stars. But no, I honestly think there are concrete differences in the development of these guys we can point to between the current sort of U20s, U22s, and the U20s of yore.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, and there's a lot we can get into to sort of show this, but why don't you start? Why do you think it's different? How is this different from, like, the Stu Holden class or whatever?
Well, so you and Joey Antone did an awesome dive into the U20s, and you guys really get into it. And what I love is that makes me super excited to now watch the U20 World Cup. But I think it's a great comparison point to take the guys that you're talking about right now and comparing them to like the 2009 and the 2011, the 2013 classes of U20s, those cycles. And basically when you're talking about those cycles, not 2009, 2011, 2013 U20 World Cup cycles, you're essentially talking about that missing generation that never really contributed to the senior national team.
Yep.
Those are the players like born from 1990 to 1994. So who do we have from that group? Like it's essentially DeAndre Yedlin, Bobby Wood, and Jorge Villafania. I think are the guys who really were national team who had any real impact on the cycle.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's right. There may be one we're missing there, but I mean Will Trapp is kind of in that class, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it'd be tough to make a case that Will Trapp has contributed much to the to the last cycle, you know.
Agreed.
So at best, maybe some fringe guys, kind of hiding around the edges. So if that's who you're comparing it to, then we have to say, all right. So what's different about the guys that you and Joey just discussed at length? And for me, I think you have to. So you got to say, how were they developed? If they're different, you know, there's not going to be anything magic that made it. You have to point to like real things that would have made them different. And I think you can easily point to the introduction and evolution of the development academies as what sort of could be. I'm going to say it's definitely a difference. And so then the question will be, is it actually going to have an effect? Like, is there going to actually be a shift in ability or sort of the number of players we're churning out that are able to play at a high level?
And this is something you mentioned in a past podcast, that like this class that is sort of graduating from high school, for lack of a better way of saying it right now, is these guys have been essentially in a professional soccer environment since adolescence, right?
Right.
That's the difference.
So yeah, so I mean the Development Academy I think was launched in like 2007. So that would actually, in 2007, those missing generation kids would have been between like 13 and 17, I think. So some of them might have caught it like at the very end of their, you know, youth career. Other guys would have been, you know, if you're 13, you're going to be in the DA right away. But at the beginning of its life, like the DA still wasn't like a terrific training environment. Like it was just U15 to U18. And I think the key piece is they ran like a shortened calendar. Their season was short because most of the kids, because this is America and there are a lot of cultural sort of institutions already existing, these kids would go play for their high school. They literally like, you know, go play high school for a season and then go to the DA. And I don't think this is the place where we're going to have this big high school versus club argument. But I could definitely, I think very few people, even the ones who who make the case for kids playing high school soccer, it almost never like comes from a soccer development stance. Like it's always like these sentimental reasons. So, and if you think about it now, it'd be mind blowing. Like imagine Richie Ledesma going up to his USL or his coach and saying like, "Hey, I'm just gonna take off for the fall and play with a bunch of my buddies." Like
Scottsdale
I'll be back in December. Like that's insanity. Like there's no way that anybody would think that that would be the optimal way to develop a soccer player.
Right. I mean, it may not. It's not. And I know you're not saying this, but it's not insanity for like the vast majority of kids, you know, to like just have a normal high school experience and play some casual high school soccer on the side and maybe win a state championship here or there. But for Rich Ledesma, who is basically top 1% of 1% of American players at his age, don't make no sense.
Right. And again, I continue to work for a high school team. I've been coaching in high school for almost like over 15 years now.
Really?
Like, yeah. So, like I love high school soccer. I think it's a blast, but I'm never going to say it's an optimal development for trying to get someone as far as they can in their soccer ability. It is like not even, it's not an ideal training environment.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
So yeah, so all these missing generation kids, all these U20 cycles that we had, they were all playing like high school soccer for 3 months, and then they'd go to their DA, and then when they like graduate high school, the other thing, like they have nowhere to play after that. Like I shouldn't say they have nowhere to play. If they can't make the first team of their for an MLS team, or they haven't begged onto a European team, been able to move overseas and sign a contract. Like the default form was college, right?
Yep.
That's where like probably half of each of the U20 teams in those cycles were playing college soccer.
Yeah, I took a look at the 2009 roster. I took a close look at it, and I'll tell you why I took a look at that year, because 2010 was really the high water mark for national team players abroad. In this, you know, in our era.
Okay.
We had 19 of our 23.
For the senior team, you're saying?
Yeah, for the senior team.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
19 of the 23 members of the World Cup squad in South Africa were not playing in Major League Soccer. Now, a couple were in Mexico. A lot were in, like, the championship and, you know, other smaller leagues in Europe. But then a few were in the Premier League, and Bradley was at Mönchengladbach, I think. So I look at the U20 World Cup roster from that essentially the same cycle. And out of the 20 or so players on that roster, 9 were in college when they played in the World Cup. So like you said, about half. And
again, college, you know, I'm sure players are probably getting better while they're in college, but not anywhere near the rate of somebody who's in an academy setting or a professional setting. The rules and the scheduling is just not geared for that. It's just sort of it's a completely different universe.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't want our good players going to college right now unless it's a weird circumstance or something.
Not if maximizing their soccer ability is the goal. If their goal is to enjoy their soccer and have all these other like different experiences, go for it. But if you're trying to maximize your soccer ability, no, playing in a university is not the way to go.
Are you saying if you want to hit on someone else's girlfriend and not have it become a national scandal, it's better to go to college?
No, that's actually probably where you learn not to do those kinds of things, where you learn those sorts of codes.
Yeah. Okay. So 9 of those of that 20-man roster was in college, and as you've noted, that's not the optimal place to get better at soccer. And the other 11 were, you know, nobody from that roster has been a national team, regular national team contributor, except for Jorge Villafania, and
who came in real sort of late to the party, right?
Yeah. And he just ultimately was just only just good enough at left back for a team that failed to qualify for the World Cup. So he's not, you know, he shouldn't be the standard, hopefully.
Right. But in that's back then, I feel like the MLS roster rules were a little bit more restrictive. We didn't have any avenue for these, for guys who weren't in the first team at an MLS side to be playing in. So they're just, they are. We talk about England being a languishing island. Like, the guys were just, they were just kind of screwed. Like, this group of players just.
They just had nowhere to go.
Yeah. But then things started to change where. This is what we talked about in 2012. Claudio Reyna had been working really hard on this, and then obviously Jurgen Klinsmann came and as the head coach. He was very vocal about moving the academies to a more professional environment, going 10 months, getting rid of disappearing and playing high school soccer. And that's what happened in 2012. So if we make a change in 2012, we made that, like, it's. Of course, you're not going to see the difference in 2013 or 2004. Like, you're going to see the difference once you've had kids go through the full. Yeah, once you've had kids go through the full training process.
Yeah.
So 2012, they moved to 10 months. 2013, they added U13 and U14 teams. So now we're getting kids into training, into this professional environment at age 13. You're sort of modernizing the path that they take, the process that you're putting them through. So what you would expect is, if this does work, then what you would expect to see is, I would say, like, the distribution of talent, the curve should shift to the right. Like, we should see better players, and probably you should have more. So it should be we should shift it to the right and up on the y-axis. That's what you would expect if this works, right?
Yeah, more and better.
If all of these initiatives work, that's what you would see. And so then the question is, it's 2000. We have some returns on this.
I don't need your trigonometry, Greg.
So we now have our very early returns, and the sample size is still very small, but we have two then 18-year-olds. Starting regularly for the number 2 and 3 team in the Bundesliga. We have a Tyler Adams who's, you know, not necessarily dominating MLS, but who is a dominant player for his team. Absolutely. At age 18 in MLS. Again, you don't want to jump to a huge conclusion, but you also, I don't think you should, that can't be ignored. And I think right now its significance is probably being underestimated because it's happening within the context of the U.S. missing out on a World Cup, where that's a huge doom and gloom situation. I think we're what is the future? There's all this sort of despair, but I think we're kind of underestimating the significance of these early returns from the DA.
Yeah. That dot is moving to the right and upward, and there's a lot of evidence of that. I think it's not just Tyler Adams, but, like,
right.
We're sort of jumping around here with our historical examples, but let me just throw one in there. You know, if you look at our U20 player pool right now, if we had made it to the World Cup, then we would have Tyler Adams.
Christian, you're talking about the senior team's World Cup. If we had played in Russia last month.
Yes.
Okay.
If we had played in Russia last month in the World Cup, we would have had most likely 3, maybe even 4 teenagers on that roster. Christian Pulisic and Weston McKennie and Tyler Adams, I think any sane manager would have put them on the roster, right?
Right, yes. From the end of qualifying through to June, they would have had chances to work them in, and they would have.
And then, nobody wants to hear this, but I think that if Jonathan Gonzalez, if we had made it to the World Cup, there's a good chance Jonathan Gonzalez would have been on the roster too. Now his form has dropped off a little bit, but it's not dropped off as much as everybody would like to think. That would be, so let's just say three conservatively. Three would be more than we've ever had, more teenagers than we've ever had on a World Cup roster. We've never, I don't think we've ever even had one. DeMarcus Beasley and Landon Donovan were 20 in 2002, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
That's the only time we've had two players that young on a World Cup roster. Both were playing in MLS. Meanwhile, Pulisic and McKenny are both, you know, on Champions League bound Bundesliga squads. So yeah. I mean, right there, that's a big, I think that's a quantitative difference.
Yeah, if you're like a Bayesian mathematician, like we didn't, like McKenny and Pulisic didn't just sort of match our previous like output. Like they've catapulted past what we had our players doing. The first year that our academy has been has gone through its cycle. So,
yeah,
I also don't think you should expect every year to have a McKenny and a Pulisic. Like if that's the very end of the tail on the right side, like sometimes we'll hit that. That'll be the end of the tail, and sometimes it'll be a little bit farther to the left. I hope people are visualizing what I'm talking about here. Like we won't always, you won't always get that many standard deviations away. But I do think that it can be sort of underplayed what's happened in the last year and a half.
Yeah, well, it, as long as we're in this orgy of agreement here, another thing to talk about, to go back to, is the comparison between the 2009 U20 World Cup roster and the likely 2019 U20 World Cup roster.
Mm-hmm.
We already talked about how many are in college. We're in college in 2009. There's a good chance there'll only be one or two, maybe three or four players in college on that U20 roster. The rest are sort of have come up in this system that you've been describing and are either MLS professionals or they're at an academy in Europe. Or, you know, if Tab Ramos gets lucky, he might get some first teamers from Europe on this squad. And there's also the USL, which is new. I don't know if you were gonna get into that, but
That's the other big development is where literally you have like a Julianas who, again, if you were in that 2009 group, he'd be playing like high school teams, and now he's playing professional soccer for a full season. The difference in development probably can't be overstated.
Yeah,
it moves the ceiling higher, much higher, for every Julianas out there.
Right. 2009 to 2019 comparison again. If you look at the U20 player pool in 2009. There was only really one nailed-on first-team player in that pool, and he's well-known to all of us. His name is Jozy Altidore. He was at Villarreal kind of feeling his way at the time. There were others that had gotten some spot starts in MLS, but only a handful of those, and most of them were in either spot minutes in MLS or in college, or they were in Europe and just not playing at all. Brian Arguez and Jared Jeffrey are the ones who come to mind. I don't know if those names ring a bell for anyone. So pretty, you know, like in terms of professional experience, you had some getting MLS minutes, and then there were, you know, some getting second division minutes, something akin right. to the USL. Let's compare that to now, where there are a lot of players in the U20 player pool getting USL minutes, which we think is a good thing. But if you look at the pool, not who's going to be available, but who would be available in sort of an ideal Tab Ramos world, Tyler Adams and Jonathan Amon are both important first-team players for their teams. That's already better than 2009 right there, when it was just Altidore.
Right, so we're talking, we already have these Altidore level or above players.
Yeah, well, those
two. Not necessarily Altidore now, but Altidore in 2009, what his situation was.
I mean, Altidore was a little unusual because he had just gone to Villarreal for like a $10 million transfer.
Yeah.
So he might. I mean, Tyler Adams.
That could be Adams, yeah.
Fetch that, but might not.
No, but in any event, we've got a player who's looking at a European, like a decent money European move here with Tyler Adams.
Yeah, I mean, there's also been rumblings about Amon if he's healthy and can, you know, put together a, you know, a full season and show what he can do. He'd be a transfer target in Europe. And then that's just, I'm just getting started with the current pool. So that those two, and then you got Tim Weah and Josh Sargent, who, you know, we're not sure, but they're likely to get first team minutes this year. I mean, Tim Weah already has. Josh Sargent's already played with the senior national team and looked pretty good. That's four who are better than all but Altidore at this stage in their careers. And then we have Jalen Lindsay, right back for Sporting KC, Mark McKenzie, a center back for Philadelphia Union, and Chris Durkin, aforementioned holding midfielder for DC United. They're all regular MLS starters, basically nailed-on starters right now in Major League Soccer. So conservatively, we have seven players who are head and shoulders above all but one of their 2009 counterparts. And we haven't even mentioned Andrew Carlton yet. Or Chris Richards, or, you know, Serginho Dest at the Ajax Academy.
Yeah, so this is it's impossible, I think, to say that things aren't different. Like, these are real differences between generations.
Yeah.
And it's, again, this is exactly what you would expect if you consider sort of the adjustments that we made to the way we develop our soccer players. You'd expect to have more players playing professionally at a young age, and you'd expect them to be better than the prior generation.
Yeah.
And this is where, for like a guy like Will Trapp, this like spells terrible news for Will Trapp, and the likelihood of him sort of being the or, you know, players in this generation, or in Will Trapp's generation, of trying to hold on and hold out and earn a spot in 2022. Because the guys who are coming up have all the tools Will Trapp had when he was getting educated and stuff, but they're getting a much better soccer development. They're getting a much better schooling.
Yeah.
And there's just going to be so many of them coming up that it's really unlikely that three to four of them aren't going to sort of just end up beating out like a Will Trapp.
Yeah.
If you're doing sort of that mathematical projection.
Yeah. It's like you always say, it's a numbers game. You just, as cold hearted as it sounds, you just throw as many soldiers as you can at the enemy fortifications, and somebody's gonna get across the line. The enemy fortifications being American, in this metaphor, being American soccer mediocrity.
So yeah, the numbers game, and then the environment that you're training them in. So those two things, both of those things.
Yeah, but you get those numbers because of the environment.
Right. Right.
I mean, you had some random thoughts on the U20 World Cup too. I mean, did you?
Aren't
exactly related to this, but are, you know?
Well, like, I mean, they are and they aren't. So, I thought there was something really cool that Paul Carr did on his Twitter account, where he was going through he was just kind of looking at U20 rosters from years past for the U.S., but then also for like France and for Spain and for various countries that have had success. And it sort of just goes along with what I would always say about guys just aren't going to pan out. You're really excited about this U20 roster, and it's like, okay, that's great, but, you know, none of them are going to pan out. And even if things are different, like, that's still kind of going to be the case. They're not going to – only a few of them can play for the senior – only a few of them will make the full jump to the senior national team. And, again, it's sort of easy to forget the numbers at play here. Like, I went through and did a quick check on the ages of the youngest and oldest players on the roster for all the teams that made it to the round of 16 in the World Cup. And the average youngest age was 21, and the average oldest age, even with Rafa Márquez in the mix, was 33. So that's like seven U20 cycles between ages 21. You're catching players from seven U20 cycles in there. And at 20, this was outfield ages. I didn't include goalkeepers because I felt like that might end up really. But anyway, seven U20 cycles for each country to be trying to pick their players from. At 20 players per roster, like that's 140 people, right?
Yeah. You know, so you have shave off a little bit on each end. I don't know, because you're mostly picking from those like middle four cycles.
But. Yeah. So you should probably see that in your distribution curve of more coming from the middle ages than the youngest or oldest. But in any event, you're looking at 140 players, and you know only 23 of them are going to be on your World Cup roster. So that's just the nature of the pyramid, that since you have to turn over your full U20 team pretty much every 2 years, but you only turn over your national team fully every 8 to 12 years.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like that's just what's going to happen. You're going to have a lot of fringe and sort of players in the discard pile.
Yeah, and it's in one way it's encouraging, because on one hand you're like, oh, you look at those pictures that Paul Carr put up, for instance, of like, I think he put up the 2009 roster, and most of the names on there are unrecognizable, or not unrecognizable, but they're just a distant hint of a memory.
Yeah.
And on one hand, that's for me, like, depressing. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, for me, it's remembering being really excited about all of those guys. Like, this guy's going to come in and take over Carlos Bocanegra's spot or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Like, finally we'll have a left back, and then none of them turned into real left backs.
Yeah. The heartbreak is deep for you, Greg. And I think for a lot of people that's depressing. But then when you consider what you just mentioned about there being seven U20 cycles for each senior team cycle, essentially, it's not so bad, because you really only need two, maybe three of those guys to on each roster to become a contributor to the national team.
And there's more stuff that goes into sort of how we think about the U20 team. I know you've, or it's been sort of shown that success at the U20 level correlates to success later in the senior for the senior team. But I think you want to be careful and not necessarily say that it's a causation. I think success at the U20 level is just sort of is an indicator that you have a really talented pool at that age. And so of course, like as that pool moves forward, you're going to see that success bear out again at the senior team level. And that's why, like, even though you only have two guys from that team make it, like everyone in that pool is like, how would I say this? So if you're looking at the Spanish, at Spain's U20 cycle from like 2005, and guys like, you're talking guys like David Silva on this team. Like Fernando Torres never made a U20 team. It wasn't on the U20 World Cup team for Spain. And it's not necessarily that he's overlooked or they picked the wrong players. Like, it just means that in 2005, at that time, like, there were a bunch of players who were as good or better than Fernando Torres. And that's sort of I feel like that's one of the lessons here is that.
Well, Torres was such a superstar that already that he was unavailable? I mean, it could be.
Oh, that's about probably that. True. Yeah, that's probably true. But I just want to, like, have this perspective on the U20s that development's not necessarily linear. So just because it's just this arbitrary snapshot of where your pool stands at that moment. So when you pick your 20 players, there's no reason to think that those 20 guys will be your best 20 players at that age a year from then or 2 years from now, 3 years from now.
Right. When you say development is not linear, you're saying the dot doesn't travel at a perfect 45 degree angle between the X and the Y axis.
Right. You're going to have a bunch of jumps and setbacks and plateaus and injuries, or you're going to land in an environment where you have a terrible coach, or like you know, you and Joey were in your U20 deep dive, or got into a kind of a long discussion about like a Paxton Pomykal, right? About
Yeah.
whether he'd make. So this is sort of the whole essence of it. If he's super close to making it, but doesn't quite beat out Yuli Yanez, like maybe Yanez just had a jump in ability right before the World Cup, and Paxton might jump him again 6 months from now when he has a like something click. So the fact that you have a bunch of players close to Yuli Yanez's level, if Yanez is really good, then that means Paxton Pomykal is also pretty good, and that's where it goes back into the numbers game of it's impossible to know which of those guys is going to end up being better a year and a half from now, but the fact that you have a lot of them at that level bodes well.
Yeah, and I mean, something that Real Madrid put out after Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, made the move to Juventus, they put out a very gracious official statement, and they said something to the effect of like his talent, his dedication, and his, you know, commitment to improvement will always, you know, were an example for our club. And that commitment to improvement part really stuck out to me. That, like, you know, we don't know how these eight who these 18-year-old kids are really, but what it's going to come down to on an individual level is which one of them has the sort of neurotic drive to get better and keep getting better and win over the next 10 years, you know? And
Yeah.
I don't know how you identify that in a teenager necessarily, but that's what it's going to come to. That's what's going to separate the Paxton Pomykals and the Julianas from each other.
Yeah, it's going to be that, and it's going to be, I mean, there's going to be like an element of luck to it too, in the sense of Jonathan Amon's been hurt for 11 months. Like, there's always that possibility that if he had been healthy and had made the right impression on someone in the right time in the last 11 months, he might have been plucked up by somebody else. And then, that would have changed the whole trajectory of his career.
Yeah. Although there's no reason yet to feel too bad for Jonathan because he does have a professional contract and it's not like it's not like he's languishing at the Fulham U23s.
No, there's not that level of languishing, but I just. But you like you never know when sort of those moments might have occurred. And so yeah, so there and you got to keep working so that when the next one does occur, you don't miss that one. But it's for any of these guys, it's possible that they've already had some bad luck that's cost them a little bit, like an opportunity somewhere.
Yeah, no doubt. Okay. So, to wrap it all up, this time is different.
That's different this time, Bells. We'll find out if this different is good enough, but I mean, we don't know that yet because again, this is sort of the test case. This is like year zero.
Lot of reason to be excited, I think. I'm excited. When we come back, we'll do a couple short corners, and they're good ones, so stick around. Okay, short corners. The big news in MLS. Well, there's been two big stories in MLS this week. First one is Alphonso Davies signing with Bayern or being transferred to Bayern. The reported transfer fee is $13 million. Davies is a teenager for the Vancouver Whitecaps. Can play on either wing. Very exciting player. How big of a deal is this?
I think this is a huge deal. I think this is sort of the first sign that some MLS teams are going to take advantage of the fact that they get to keep that entire amount of money. for a homegrown player, which I believe Davies qualifies as. That's awesome. I'm hoping that's the first of many big money sales that MLS make.
Yeah. I hope it's the first of many, too, but there's a lot of responsibility on Alfonso's shoulders now. What if he doesn't pan out? He's only 17, right?
Yeah, he's only 17. I don't think that's going to what I think is great is that he is going to Bayern, because Bayern probably makes, I mean, they make 13 million. That's nothing for Bayern. Like 13 million is nobody's going to be like, this is the guy who we're going to place all our hopes on because we spent 13 million on.
Oh, yeah, that's Bayern. True.
If it were like a mid-table Premier League team doing that, that'd be splashing a decent amount of money for him. That's when guys start to get that like failure label attached to them.
Right. Yeah, I guess I don't have a good sense of how the market, you know, how much clearly the market pays attention to this, and will, you know, sort of it'll be incorporated into future valuations for MLS players. And how he plays will be incorporated into those valuations. But you got to think, like, he's not going to play immediately at Bayern. Are they going to throw him on a U19 side? I doubt that, too. So maybe a loan? Maybe a loan to Bundesliga? I don't know. But I guess the point I'm making is I'm really rooting for him to succeed, because the last time we had a big money transfer of a young attacker from MLS, it was Jozy Altidore, who, you know, had a kind of a mixed time in Europe.
Right. Yeah. I'm hoping Davies gets like loaned out to a team with another American on it, so we can just watch our attack flourish. I know Davies isn't an American, it'd just be fun to watch the MLS products run at people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a big deal, no doubt about it. Just a brief mention. This is not one of the big stories of the week, but I mean, Will Trapp had an absolute stunner of a golazo over the weekend. You know, we talked about him earlier as somebody who needs to be looking over his shoulder, but you know, credit where credit's due. It was a stoppage time 30-yard blast, top corner, totally unstoppable. The ball was shimmying in the air as it went. I just want to make a note of that.
I saw that goal. I did. It was an absolute banger.
Okay. Agree to agree.
I'm giving it's one of those things where I just give Greg Berhalter all the credit.
The system created that goal. And of course the other big story in MLS is Kellen Acosta to the Colorado Rapids. What do you make of this?
I hope it goes well for him. It's one of those things where, again, I've completely prepared myself for every single guy that we, all of these under 25-year-old guys that we talk about. I am prepared for all of them to sort of
play for Colorado. Plateau.
Yeah, to plateau, play for Colorado, have a nice professional career into their early 30s. You can't be surprised when it happens. And I'm not saying Kellen Acosta's done by any means, but I do think a lot of people read it as like, I mean, they thought he was going to, again, continue to just be this rising star. And that's just not the way the game works.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your thought? I mean, it seems like a fine move.
Yeah, I actually don't mind it. I mean, it does signal that, I mean, the rumblings, or maybe it's even been reported, you know, explicitly, is that there is no interest from Europe now. There is no interest from Europe in Acosta anymore. There was last summer. Dallas thought they should get more money for him than they were offered, and they didn't want to give up on him. They didn't want to give him up in the middle of a playoff push. Well, they didn't sell him. They didn't make the playoffs. He's now basically riding the bench for them behind some other guys who are playing better, including Ja'Cory Hayes friend of the pod. And so it makes, you know, it's sad in that way. Like, he should have been sold to Europe when he was 22 and gotten, you know, gotten a chance to prove himself over there. Now, of course, no guarantee he would have done that, but would have liked to have seen it. I mean, everybody wanted him. All national team fans wanted him to go last year. But
yeah, this
in this moment, the move makes sense. He needs to go to a place where he's the guy and he can get playing time. Colorado needs a midfielder. Dallas doesn't need him.
Right. In this moment, the move makes sense. It's not the move you would have expected for if Kellen Acosta is going to be the next starting midfielder for the U.S. national team.
No. Yeah, he's got a hill to climb. He needs to be dominant for Colorado, and I, you know, that's a really bad soccer team. So.
This sort of situation, all the things you just described, as far as the interest from Europe, and now, you know, Dallas kind of taking a bath on that and getting a, you know, trading him for much less than what he was rumored to be worth to Europe 2 years ago. Do you see any parallels to Columbus turning down the offer for Zach Steffen?
Eerie parallels. Yes. I mean, even the numbers are similar. Wasn't it like 3 to 4 million is what Dallas is being offered for Acosta?
And now, that's the thing. I'm not sure what if there were any concrete offers, and if there were, what they would have totaled for Acosta. But
I mean, 3 to 4 million was the scuttlebutt. I mean, okay. Who knows? But 4 million. Bristol City offered 4 million, again reportedly, for Steffen, and Columbus turned that down.
So yeah, that's cash on the table. Like so Zach Steffen though isn't a Columbus homegrown, right? So my question is, would Columbus have pocketed the full amount, or would they have had to share with MLS?
They would have to share with MLS. Exactly okay. How much I'm not sure, but. Some amount that is unappealing to the Columbus front right. office. Yeah, it's and when the Acosta deal didn't happen, Dallas would have had to share some of the transfer fee with MLS too. That rule changed.
In the last few okay. months,
so right. that they get 100% of teams will get 100% of homegrown transfer fees, but okay. that wasn't the case last summer. So, you know, that's obviously a factor. And you'd hate to see Steffen have a little bit of a dip in form or, you know, or an injury or something in the next year and then there not be any offers anymore and, you know, he goes to the Chicago Fire or something. I don't know. But it's not certainly not out of the realm of possibility.
Right. I love what our purgatory clubs are.
Yeah, what are the other purgatory clubs? I mean, Colorado's the poster boy for purgatory.
I don't know. Like, I kind of don't have that same, like, feeling about it where Kellen Acosta missed out on his chance to prove it in Europe. Like, if he can't work his way back into Dallas's starting lineup, I mean, that sort of tells you, doesn't it? Like, that... He's not where he would have. He just isn't the caliber of player right now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's fair. I mean, I want to make excuses for him there. Like he's, you know, he's still sort of working his way back to fitness. Carlos Grueso and Victor Ulloa are both solid midfielders, maybe with a little more bite than Acosta. I don't know. Yeah, you're right.
But again, I expect this, and there's going to be more guys that we're high on that are going to plateau, and I don't even want to say disappoint us because I feel like that's like he should be ashamed of himself. Like this is just the nature of the game, and Acosta's still a good center midfielder, and there's a chance that he'll regain that form. But if he doesn't, he's going to be a solid professional for the next decade.
Yeah, he'll get some spot minutes in the Gold Cup in 2021.
especially because our senior team will be in the Confederations Cup in 2020.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'll keep paying attention to Kellen Acosta and, you know, tracking his progress. I hope he wish him the best in Colorado. It does.
Yeah.
It does seem like a sort of sad ending to his time in Dallas, though.
Right. That's just sort of the reality check for any sort of hyped up player. Like it could be that can be the story for anyone. Anyone could be is all of these guys are like 6 months away from that purgatory club.
Yeah.
Shit. Even Alphonso Davies.
Yeah, they're all walking a knife's edge. I was at the Minnesota United game on Sunday, where they beat LAFC 5-1, and LAFC scored. Minnesota scored an early goal, a very nice goal by Rasmus Schuler, assisted by Darwin Quintero, and then immediately LAFC scored an equalizer on like just sort of a scramble at the back, and I didn't even notice who was at fault for it. At first I thought it was Francisco Calvo, the center back, but about 5 minutes later, Adrian Heath, the Minnesota United coach, subbed off Alexi Gomez, the left back. You know, like it was like the 32nd minute of the first half. Bold move, subbing off your left back that early in the game. And boy, man, Gomez was just, he didn't look like he was mad. He just looked like he was devastated. He just went to the end of he went to the end of the bench, put a towel over his head. And when I say over his head, I mean over his face and his head, like just completely covered his face in a towel and just sat there for, I don't know, 5 minutes like that. Felt so bad for the guy. And it occurred to me, like, you know, when you get subbed off as a left back in the 32nd minute, you're thinking about your job security.
Right.
That's probably what he was over there thinking about. Well. Story time's over, I guess. You got any stories you want to tell, Greg?
No, I have the same thing happens here when I have an exchange that I just don't think is a great one in the podcast. I'll hang up the phone and then towel straight over the head.
Yeah, a towel to the head. Okay, all right, let's wrap it up. Thanks everybody for listening. Talk to you later.